2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the rainy, gloomy Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. Brand new month, same old weather. Brand new month, same old weather. It can be depressing, that's for sure, when you get day after day this. We had one nice day earlier this week, and that was it. Yeah, gonzo. The weather folks still calling for temperatures to climb into the upper 50s near 60. I don't know if it's going to make it or not. And here we are, 12:30, and we're still hanging around the 50-degree mark. It's not frigid, but we're expecting it to be a little warmer, which at least makes the rain a little easier to take. I don't think it's going to happen. Well, coming up on the program today, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have another candidate chat. It's going to be the last one we have prior to the election next Tuesday. We have been talking with all of the candidates in both the 15th and the 16th congressional districts. And this is the confusing part for Butler Countyans, where, you know, formerly the whole county was in one congressional district. Everybody had one congressman. That was the incumbent Republican Mike Kelly. And now, under the new lines that were drawn under court order, half of Butler County is in the 16th district. That's a new number. And half is in the 15th district, also a new number. So where are you? What district are you in? Probably going to be confusing for a lot of folks when they go to the polls next Tuesday. And to make it even more complicated, there's a handful of precincts in Cranberry Township that are in the 17th congressional district. That's just a few voters. Most folks are going to either be in 15 or 16. Now, we've talked already with Mike Kelly. He was with us a couple of weeks back here in the studio. We talked a few days ago with Ron DeNicola. He's the Democratic candidate in that 16th district, facing Republican incumbent Mike Kelly. Yesterday, we talked with Susan Bossier. She's the Democratic candidate in the 15th district. And that's the eastern half of Butler County, and then all the way over to Center County. So we talked with Susan Bossier yesterday. Today, we talk with the other candidate in that district, and it's the Republican incumbent, five-term incumbent, as a matter of fact, Glenn G.T. Thompson. He's on the road on the campaign trail, as most candidates are, but he'll be chatting with us by telephone in just a couple of minutes, actually, here on the program today. We also invite you to stay tuned. Looking forward to a chat with a military historian. He's a defense expert. Political scientist. His name is John Caldwell. He trained as a political scientist. In fact, he has a PhD in political science from University of California at Santa Barbara. But he ended up working for almost all of his working career in America's defense think tanks and with aerospace companies. So he knows a lot about defense. He has written a book that studies four of America's wars: World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, and Iraq, and how each of those wars ended differently. World War II, victory for America and its allies. Korea, stalemate. In fact, we still haven't resolved that. That was back in the early 50s. Vietnam, where we lost, Americans lost, as the French had done, and then what he terms failure in Iraq. So he looks at all four of these wars and compares them side by side, what happened, what didn't happen, what should have happened, so on and so forth. So I'm anxious to talk to him, John D. Caldwell. He'll be visiting with us later on the program today. But first, we take a quick break here, and then we'll get ready to hook up by telephone with G.T. Thompson. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. You know, they operate a wonderful food bank for the needy and the less fortunate in our community. There are many people, many, many families who rely on the food bank at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. You can help out in many ways. You can donate items, first of all, to the food bank. You can volunteer there and help to distribute the food, help to store it and distribute it. Or you can donate unwanted items to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart on Route 8 South, because through the operation of that store, they help to fund the food bank. In fact, every penny that's generated through the operation of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store goes to help support the food bank and their client aid program. So if you're doing a little cleaning, and many folks will, now boy, it's November. Today's November the 1st. How close are the holidays? 3 weeks from today is Thanksgiving Day. Don't want to scare anybody, but check your calendar. It's 3 weeks from today. So if you're getting ready for the holiday season by doing a little cleaning, maybe cleaning out the spare bedroom in the closet or the attic or whatever, consider donating clothing, shoes, furniture, household items, and so on to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store. It'll help. It'll help a lot. They're open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., located Greater Butler Mart, Route 8, just south of Butler. Plenty of free parking right outside the door, and their drop-off bins are right inside the door. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Butler. We stand tallest when we stoop to help others.
Fall flower bulbs are in at Osterling's Lawn and Garden. Stop in for tulips, crocuses, hyacinths, and more. Don't forget Espoma organic flower fertilizer, bulb dust, and bulb planters. Stock up on pantry staples like Radic cutlery gift sets, Conjager jerky mixes, and a variety of flour. Plus, Osterling's has post-property signs, reflective driveway markers, Imperial whitetail supplements, dog and cat warmer, Hamilton dog collars, and check out the new Halloween and Thanksgiving greeting cards from Leanin' Tree. You can find it all at Osterling's Lawn and Garden in Butler.
We have another one of our candidate chats coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR today. My name is Dave Malarkey, and we're pleased to be able to chat for a few minutes on the program today with the incumbent Republican congressman in the 15th District, and he is Glenn G.T. Thompson. Congressman, nice to meet you. First time we've had a chance to chat here.
Dave, nice to talk with you. I appreciate the opportunity.
You are new to most voters in Butler County. In fact, Butler County is new to the 15th District. Let's talk about that a little bit before we start. This is a new number. It's a new district. It's according to the lines that were recently redrawn under court order. I would say that probably the easiest way to understand it is the eastern half of Butler County is now in the 15th District. Would you say that's the easiest way to understand it?
Yeah, I think so. It's, it's the eastern portion. So it includes townships like Buffalo and Oakland and Summit, but also, Chicor and Bruin and Petrolia boroughs. That's the best way to sum it up.
Mm-hmm. And the district geographically is a large one. It extends all the way over to Center County, and it goes all the way up to the New York state line. My goodness, that's tough to cover, huh, in terms of personal appearances.
Well, there's a lot of square miles there. It's about 24% of the landmass of the state. That's, for 10 years now, I'm in my fifth term. That's, my district's always been that large, and so it's worked out well. I represent by showing up. I really appreciate being a part of the community, serve, and that's a real privilege, and to be able to be in the townships, the boroughs, there's visiting businesses, manufacturers, different community organizations. So it seems a little overwhelming, being that it's about 11,000 square miles. But I'll say that it's my approach, my style of serving by showing up. It's worked relatively well.
Well, for people here in Butler County who may not be familiar with you, maybe you can take a couple of minutes and kind of introduce yourself, Glenn Thompson. Tell us who you are.
Yeah, well, first of all, please call me GT. That's what everybody does. That was a nickname that my parents gave me, and it's not that it's not complicated. It's just my first initial and the last initial. I'm Glenn Jr., so I was named after my dad, but they chose, and everybody today calls me GT. I've been, I My background, having grown up here in rural Pennsylvania, I still live in within sight of where I can see my parents' home and the sporting goods business that I grew up in from my home that I've had for I guess probably 35 years or more with my wife Penny. I tell people I married into the executive branch. She was my seventh grade class president. So we didn't marry in seventh grade, but we married when we were 21. That's when we met. I have three wonderful sons that all three are Eagle Scouts. Scouting's been a big part of my life. I'm an Eagle Scout and I've been a Scoutmaster for at this point. Master of my troop for probably almost 30 years. We were proud of our kids. We made them way too independent. I don't know. They're doing well. One is working to develop a small business, and one is a Purple Heart decorated soldier, and one is was a music teacher serving in middle school. My background actually was serving individuals facing life-changing disease and disability in nonprofit community health care. Did that for 28 years and enjoyed doing that. It was nonprofit community health care. You weren't going to get rich. In fact, I figured eventually I would probably retire from that, although retirement would probably have been getting a discount on one of the nursing home beds. And so... God's got a sense of humor, and I found a calling to continue my service to the community and making a difference in the lives of my neighbors. 10 years ago, when there was an open seat, running and earning first the nomination and then the seat to serve what was the Pennsylvania 5th Congressional District, now being renumbered to the Pennsylvania 15th Congressional District. State certified firefighter, EMT, rescue technician, former school board member, former member of the private industry council for the Central Corridors, which was about workforce development. Doing what a lot of people are doing, a lot of the listeners, obviously the WISRs, who work hard, but also try to give back to the community to make a difference in the lives of their neighbors. That's what my life has been all about, and quite frankly, that's what my service in Congress is all about.
Just to make sure, and one of our purposes in talking with candidates is to make sure that voters are not confused, how will your name appear on the ballot,
Congress? Well, I think it's going to be on there, both Glenn G.T. Thompson.
Okay.
With those nicknames, I think that's the way the Department of Elections chose to list it.
Well, I have a couple of questions for you with regard to issues, but I'd like to start out by asking you what you see as key issues that Congress will be facing over the next 2 years following the election. What do you think is most important?
Well, on top of the list, I believe is workforce. One time we talked about jobs, but as I spend time in Butler County and the other the additional 13 counties that will make up the Pennsylvania 15th Congressional District, it's the jobs are there. We have our employers, those people who sign the front of a paycheck, they're desperately looking for people who are qualified and trained. So we don't have a jobs problem now, we have a workforce problem. And that's something I lead the nation on. I am the national leader on career and technical education training. It was my legislation. I was proud to join President Trump in the Oval Office. This is a bill, that a good friend of mine, someone that I helped mentor when he came in, Congressman Mike Kelly, he and Vicky are good friends with Penny and I, and Mike was one of my original co-sponsors on that legislation. I was proud to be with the president when he signed that into law to restore rungs in the ladder of opportunity to help individuals who are underemployed, unemployed, maybe been living in poverty for generations, to have a chance at the American dream by getting a better access to more effective skills-based education. And so I always put that there. Energy is important to Butler County and to the rest of the district. We are the we really are the energy congressional district for the country. When you look at our legacy, that what we've had, whether we're talking coal or oil or gas or timber. And so, as someone who's a senior member on the Natural Resource Committee, that's something I work hard to make sure that our families and our business owners have access to affordable, reliable energy. I know those issues are important, and something I lead on. I'm national co-chair of the Congressional Natural Gas Caucus. Agriculture, our number one industry in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, it's always close to being number one, if not number one, in all of our counties. And as the vice chair of the House Agriculture Committee and chair of the Nutrition Subcommittee, I work hard to make sure that our farmers are in a position that they're not overwhelmed by unnecessary regulations, that they have a chance at making a decent dollar for working so hard like they do. And in particular, our dairy farmers today, which have been struggling dramatically as a result of government. Back in 2009, 2010, I witnessed, when led by Nancy Pelosi, Congress stripped away milk fat out of our school milk, and resulting in serving our kids chalk water now for 8 years. And we've actually lost an entire generation of milk drinkers. The kids are missing out on nutrition because that's where what milk fat provides. And they miss out on the flavor, so they're not asking mom and dad to buy a gallon of milk when they go home and weigh in on the grocery list. And that's resulted in just tremendous financial distress for our dairy farmers, and it's cheated our kids of proper nutrition in schools. And so I'm proud that actually we're restoring milk fat with my legislative language implemented by Secretary Perdue, but we have a lot more to do in that area as well.
We're talking, listeners, if you happen to be joining us a little bit late on this segment of the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, I'm Dave Milwaukee. Our guest is the Republican incumbent congressman in what is now the 15th Congressional District. G.T. Thompson is chatting with us here today. And we're introducing him to Butler County voters who will have the opportunity to vote for him for the first time. President Trump is campaigning heavily, obviously, for Republicans, holding rallies. He held a rally in Erie a couple of weeks back. Were you there, G.T.?
I was. I actually spoke at the rally before the president came out. It was just a tremendous opportunity. Dave, if I'm reelected, I'm actually going to be the incoming dean for the Pennsylvania Republican delegation. So and with my legislative leadership, I work very closely with the president and with the White House, and it's an honor to be with him, to work with him to really achieve what has been the great American comeback. When you look at unemployment, most recently the consumer confidence numbers that just came out yesterday, the fact that we've had 4 million fellow Americans, and I like to relate that to 4 million American families that have come off of the SNAP program. That program's near and dear to my heart as a chairman of the Nutrition Subcommittee for Agriculture. But we've had 4 million families come off of SNAP. That's what we used to call food stamps. And they came off not to become hungry, but they came off because they were able to get a great paying family sustaining job and get ultimate food security, which only comes through those jobs. And so I just really do think, it really has been a pleasure to work with the president in terms of the outcomes that are being delivered. It's like, Dave, when was the last time we heard about North Korea or Iran or even ISIS? Those things have, the foreign policy of the president really seems to be working. It's de-escalated. And so that coupled with, really the great American comeback, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm pretty eclectic with my work that I do. I work on the things that are important to the people that I serve. There was just an article, an op-ed today that ran in the Philadelphia Inquirer about as far away from our congressional district as what you can get in Pennsylvania. But it was there. I co-authored that, and it talked about the next piece of legislation of mine that I think we'll get to the president's desk, and that is the reauthorization of the Family Violence and Prevention Services Act. and this is a great bill. I have over 100 co-sponsors. I work really hard to work in a bipartisan way. And it provides the authorization, the funding for emergency shelters and hotlines and counseling services and legal services for people that have been the victims of violence and domestic family violence in particular. And so it passed. I managed that successfully out of the House. It passed unanimously, just like the Career and Technical Education bill did. And looking forward when the Senate gets back that they will hotline that, get that done, so that'll be the next piece of legislation that I'm leading on that will be on the president's desk.
I'm trying to remember back to my high school civics class, and I do remember that in the U.S. House, the House of Representatives, that's where tax law originates. Has to go to the Senate later, of course. But about a year ago at this time, tail end of 2017, we had the tax reform bill passed. Were you pleased with that, and do you think it needs any tweaking?
Oh, no, I was very pleased with it. Now, it didn't get everything that I wanted or we wanted, especially when it came to the tax cuts that I think matter most for families and individuals. But unfortunately, we had the Senate, and particularly the Democrats in the Senate, didn't want to go that far. And without their support, we couldn't get the votes to get that done out of the Senate and get that signed into law like that did happen. And specifically, it's the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And so that needs to be done. You know, the House has already passed the bill, probably within the past 60 days. I kind of lose track here, but where we did make we made those tax cuts permanent to provide the certainty that American families need to have. The Senate has not moved on that piece of legislation yet, but I'm hopeful that maybe that'll be a Christmas gift for the American people, that the Senate will get that done before the end of this 115th Congress.
We're talking with the G.T. Thompson. He is the Republican incumbent congressman in what is now the 15th congressional district. I know it's the Senate that has advice and consent on judicial appointments, but I've been asking all the candidates that I've chatted with for Congress if they had thoughts on the recent Brett Kavanaugh hearings and his subsequent confirmation to the High Court.
Yeah, I think Brett Kavanaugh was eminently qualified, and that's always. I'm not in the Senate, but I do observe as an interested citizen, like everyone else should be doing, of what happened within those confirmation hearings. I thought it was a real debacle about how there's a process by which, and I think that some of these senators, Cory Booker and Dianne Feinstein, Kamala Harris. I thought it was an insult to the institution of the Senate in their advise and consent role of how they, what they did with the process. I thought it was a great insult to Dr. Ford, who provided her information in a confidential way, and there was a process in place where that referral could have been made from Senator Feinstein to the Judiciary Committee so that they could, in a confidential way, done a deep dive and investigation in a timely manner, releasing her letter, and then that those investigators would have come back in a confidential way and shared information with the senators who actually had the votes for confirmation. And that didn't happen. Instead, it became a public spectacle, and I think it was an insult to Dr. Ford of how her information was released. Her accusations, it's put her in an unfortunate situation where that became public. But also, I think it really appeared to be an injustice to Brett Kavanaugh, who had been FBI investigated and Senate confirmed at least four times in his public career because of the high profile positions of service to the nation that he's had. So, and I think that. The response to that, Dave, is a part of this political environment as people go to the polls. You know, if I had to keep track of the word I've heard most as I travel around my 24% of the landmass of Pennsylvania, actually it's even greater than that because I'm still serving 16 counties. I'll lose six of those counties. I pick up four new counties. So I'm really servicing actively by showing up in 20 counties right now because I I was elected to the 5th, and I will serve the 5th through the 1st of January, but obviously I'm working hard to be in Butler. We were just in Butler at the Field House with a great event. We had folks come out most recently, just a couple days ago. And the word I hear mentioned frequently is Kavanaugh, and about how the reaction, just a strong reaction to how that process was just, how it was just so poorly managed. And so it's interesting to see what kind of a role that voters' reaction and dissatisfaction with how that was done, what role that will play in motivating people to come out to the polls.
A couple of more topics to discuss with G.T. Thompson before our time expires here. Let's talk a little bit about health care. There was a recent survey just a few days ago, as a matter of fact, coming out that health care in many parts of the country is the number one issue for voters as they go to the polls. The Republican majority in the House of Representatives voted numerous times over the past couple of years to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Did you vote to repeal that, and how do you feel about it now?
I did. I voted to repeal and replace. You know, my background is health care. I've spent 28 years serving people facing life-changing disease and disability, and was proud of the career that I've had in healthcare. It's always been important to me. You know, I've been a leader on access. I've actually led the nation on day one on the expansion of telemedicine. You want a strategy to be able to increase access to all of America, not just urban America where you can find a hospital on every block, but in rural America where, you know, you're going to have to sometimes drive a couple hours to get to our community hospital. Telemedicine can help with that, and not only is better access, but it's better access to the best possible care. And so I my first work on that was serving people who are active duty military through the STEP Act. President Obama signed that into law, and as a result, 1.1 million active duty military reserve and guard had an improvement to greater access to more quality care. It also helped to reduce the suicide rate among our military. It wasn't the only thing, but it was a part of that solution. And then most recently, President Trump, when he signed the VA Missions Act, allowing our veterans to actually get services where they want to get them in their home communities if they prefer, from their local doctors if they prefer to, included the Vets Act, which expanded telemedicine to 21 million veterans. And so I've always worked on as a leader on healthcare issues, and I've saw from the beginning that, you know, the Affordable Care Act was not going to be affordable, despite the promises that were made and obviously broken by those who were shoving that at us. You know, we've seen premium rates increase at a level that far surpassed the escalating level of health insurance from 2008 and 2009, 2010. So there's a lot of work left to be done on access to health care. I'm a big supporter of federally qualified health centers. These are wonderful for folks with low income to be able to go to. It's you pay something, but it's all based on your income, because health care is an individual responsibility as well. And the big part of it is individual responsibility, and we want it to be affordable. And then there's this whole thing that the Democrats are campaigning on across the nation about pre-existing conditions. I don't know if anybody in Washington who doesn't support that a person with pre-existing conditions should not be able to purchase affordable health insurance. That is a universal agreement. And so I find that some of the campaigning that's being done here, I see, you know, obviously some of the ads that are being put out, they're just not true, and don't reflect the reality that no matter what we do here, as we work at making healthcare more affordable and more accessible, more decision making by the patient themselves, it will include provisions to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions are able to purchase, you know, more affordable health insurance.
Our time begins to run very, very short here, but before we give G.T. Thompson a chance to summarize, just maybe a couple of quick comments, if you could, sir, on Medicare and Social Security. We continue to see stories about these programs being in trouble financially. Any thoughts there?
they are in trouble, and they're in trouble for a great reason. People are living longer. You know, when Social Security was first set up, I think the average life, you could get the benefit at age 65 at that point. Now, that's been moved up over the decades. I think my eligibility for Social Security, my cohort is like 67 and a half. But when they set it up, I think the average life expectancy was 63. And so the reason that these programs are in trouble are because of birthdays. And quite frankly, Dave, the older I get, the more I like birthdays. So my commitment is to save Medicare and Social Security. And people who are currently on it, or if you're on a glide path, let's say 5 years out, you should be planning for your retirement. So you need certainty in what those numbers are going to be, and so we shouldn't change it for those folks. I'm not on that glide path yet. If you're like my age and the rest of us, you know, if we don't do something to save these programs, they're not going to be there. You know, Medicare is supposed to become insolvent by the year 2025. That's not that far away. And Social Security, which is a huge part of people's, hopefully combined with what they personally have saved and hopefully an employer-provided program if they provide a retirement program, that's 2035. And so we need to save these programs, for the future generation. Quite frankly, we've all paid into them. I will never call those programs an entitlement. They are not. They are something that taxpayers, that we as citizens, we pay into. We need to make sure that these are worthy investments, and we get a return on investment when our time comes to enjoy retirement. So that's my commitment. I think there's a lot of work to be done on there, and many creative things that we're going to need to do. But we need to take action on this. I'm really hoping this is something the president in the next 2019 will champion, helping us to provide the leadership. I look forward to working with them to see how we save Medicare and Social Security.
Our time is gone. Can you take just a few seconds, Congressman, and kind of summarize your position and why people should consider voting for you next Tuesday?
Thank you for this opportunity, Dave, to be on the radio. I'm looking forward to earning the opportunity to serve the citizens of Butler County and all 14 counties that constitute the Pennsylvania 15th Congressional District. You know, this my election is not about me. It's not about a job for me. It's about you. It's about your family. It's about that commitment to serving my neighbors. Just my neighborhood today is about 24% of the landmass of Pennsylvania. I've got a proven record that I've done that well in a bipartisan way, and shown the type of leadership that people respond very favorably to. And I would appreciate their vote on Tuesday as I look forward to, serving the citizens of Butler and Armstrong and all the remainder of the Pennsylvania 15th Congressional District.
G.T. Thompson has been our guest. Nice to have you with us, sir. I appreciate chatting with you here today.
Dave, my privilege. Thank you so much.
Well, that wraps up our candidate chats as we have talked now with congressional candidates in both the 15th and the 16th congressional districts. The new numbers, the new division lines for voters listening to us here when you go to the polls next Tuesday. It's going to be quite a bit different in your congressional votes than it was before. For example, here in the city of Butler, you'll be voting in the 16th congressional district, but you just outside of Butler, off to the east, you're going to be in the 15th district with the different candidates. So that was, once again, G.T. Thompson, the Republican incumbent in the 15th district. Yesterday, we heard from Susan Bozier, who is the Democratic challenger, the Democratic candidate in that district. And earlier, over the past couple of weeks, we heard from the candidates in the 16th district, Mike Kelly, the Butler native, the Republican incumbent, and his challenger, Democrat Ron DeNicola. So we've heard from all of them now, and hopefully that will serve as an introduction for you and hopefully enable you to make a better choice, a more rational choice whenever you go to the polls next Tuesday. And we do hope that everybody goes to the polls. This is a big election, a midterm election, and it doesn't matter what party you're in. They've got all the big guns out on the campaign trail President Trump on the Republican side, former President Barack Obama on the Democratic side. Everybody is urging people to go vote, no matter which side you're on or which candidates you plan to vote for. Vote. By the way, we will have live election coverage here on WISR, as we always do on election night. Once the polls close around 8 o'clock, and that's always a while before we start to get even, you know, the first returns coming in, but we'll have election coverage for you next Tuesday night. Hope you can stick around on the next segment of It's Your Turn. We're going to be chatting with a military historian, also a defense expert. He's retired now, but he spent many decades, in fact, in the defense industry. His name is John D. Caldwell. He's not in Butler. In fact, he's in California. But we'll be talking with him about Anatomy of Victory. He analyzes four of America's most recent wars, and World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq, and why in each case the result came out differently. Why was that? Why were we able to win, demonstrably win, in World War II? Ended up in a draw, really, in Korea, and by most accounts lost in Vietnam. Why? Why is that? So that's what John Caldwell examines, and we'll be anxious to talk with him in just a couple of minutes. Sponsors on the program today: Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. Kelly offers personalized one-on-one care. It's not one size fits all. When you're dealing with Kelly, your hearing aid will be measured to fit your ear and your ear alone. She'll take the time to make sure that everything is the way you want it. Obviously, you're going to want to hear better, and that will be the case. But there's also a comfort factor involved. A lot of folks will, you know, get a hearing aid, and then it's not comfortable. It hurts. And as a result, they don't wear them all the time. And what good does that do you? Nothing. Kelly is interested in helping you to hear better. She is not interested in selling you the highest-priced hearing aid. In fact, you could save thousands if you deal with her, because there's no overhead. And by the way, you heard that correctly. You could save thousands. There is a complimentary consultation, so what do you have to lose? Huh? Call the hearing aid lady. Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. People who have done so or talked with her are so happy that they did. Here's phone number. 724-756-4327. Got it? 724-756-4327. Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. Another one of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. They're located just off Newcastle Road, right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants. They're in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex. But you just follow the signs. When I come up the first time I went in there, there's no problem. You just follow the signs and there you are. Gone Postal Butler. They package your items for shipping. It is a great convenience. It is a great service. You can ship any way you want. U.S. Postal Service, UPS, FedEx, you name it, they'll do it. But they'll package your items up. They also offer copying service, scanning service, faxing. You can rent a temporary mailbox there. They have an official notary if you need to get something notarized before it's sent out. You can grab a lottery ticket or a greeting card or even a jar of local honey. They're open Monday through Friday. 140 Shockey Lane. Here's a phone number. You can call them, get more information. 724-841-0044. It's Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Got an interesting segment coming up here, listeners, on the next portion of the It's Your Turn program on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is military historian John D. Caldwell. And we're talking about his book, Anatomy of Victory, Why the United States in World War II fought to a stalemate in Korea, lost in Vietnam, and failed in Iraq. Mr. Caldwell, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here for a few minutes today.
Thank you very much for including me.
How long were you studying the military? A long time, huh?
I'd say about 50 years. This has been a lifetime project for me.
Wow.
And a learning experience every step of the way.
Well, tell us about this book. What was the motivation for writing it, sir?
Well, the question you began with, you know, why did we win World War II but not do so well in the conflicts that followed? That was the central problem I wanted to address, and I wanted to do it coherently.
Well, World War II will be familiar to most of our listeners, if not personally, certainly through their studies or their reading.
And I wanted to use World War II as a benchmark, because that was the one conflict that we won where there's no argument about who won. And there were the Axis powers signed surrender documents in 1945. But one of the things I discovered in studying World War II, and I went through a whole series of 10 battles that I thought the Allies had to win or certainly couldn't afford to lose. But there was, and so I go through all of that, and a lot of that will be familiar to people who have read books on World War II. But one of the things that isn't well understood, I think, is after military operations and nation-building programs, and they lasted longer than the war itself, cost almost nearly as much.
And that was in...
That was something that was significant.
That was in both, both Germany and Japan?
Absolutely.
I'm interested in the battles that you discussed. You mentioned about 10 of them. Would D-Day be one of them? Because, you know, we look back on D-Day as a great success, but there was considerable doubt beforehand. In fact, as I recall from my reading, and I've read quite a bit about World War II, General Eisenhower actually penned an apology, did he not, before D-Day, just in case it didn't go as planned?
He did. He did, absolutely. And the actual execution of D-Day, I think, turned out to be successful, but, you know, nobody could predict that in advance. There was no way, really, to guarantee it until it actually happened.
What are some of the other battles that you talked about in World War II, sir?
Well, I go through a series of 10 battles, critical battles or campaigns, and I start with the Battle of Britain. That's before we even got involved in the war.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then the Battle of the Atlantic, again, before we really were involved. Then I go to the invasion of Russia, because that happened 13 months after Churchill became prime minister. And he gained a new ally, even before he gained us as an ally. And then I go to the Battle of El Alamein in the Western Desert, because Churchill, to stay viable as a member of the wartime coalition, had to prove that British soldiers could win somewhere, and he thought it had to be in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get involved through the battles of Midway and Guadalcanal. Then I go to the strategic bombing offensive over Europe, the invasion of Italy, and why we did that, and then D-Day and the Battle for Normandy, and then the Battle of the, what I call the Battle of the Rhine. In other words, there was 11 months of hard fighting that went on after the D-Day invasion, and it wasn't a mopping up operation. There was a lot of ugly fighting, and the German army, despite the handwriting perhaps being on the wall for them, was still a formidable adversary to deal with, and quite lethal. And then I finish off with Okinawa and the bombing of Japan. Now, that leaves out a lot, but I thought those were sort of strategic conflicts that had to be analyzed in some depth, and I did it from the perspective of what I call a strategic architecture. And then I asked the question, you know, what do we learn from all of these, the interaction of policy and strategy and operations involving presidents, dictators, generals and admirals on all sides, and what statesmen and generals do when they execute plans. That's what I was looking at. And I was interested in the interaction of all of these things, because that's how you learn things that I think apply to Korea and Vietnam and Iraq.
We're talking, listeners, with John D. Caldwell about his book, Anatomy of Victory. And Mr. Caldwell, this is the first comparison that I know where in one book you compare all of America's modern wars side by side.
I think so. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's really what I wanted to try and do, was in a single work try and explain how, you know, whether there are some common threads to all of these conflicts, and how to think about not only these conflicts and what we can learn from them, but perhaps how to think about future conflicts.
A little bit about our guest, listeners. John D. Caldwell is retired after a 50-year career studying America's wars in various defense think tanks and aerospace companies. He was trained as a political science, has a doctorate in that from the University of California in Santa Barbara. In fact, that's where we're talking with him today. He's in Santa Barbara, California. Has your book been published already, sir, or is it soon to come out, Anatomy of Victory? Tell us about that.
It's officially going to be released by my publisher, Roman and Littlefield, on November the 15th. But friends tell me they're already buying it.
Oh, okay.
And so I think it may be available in bookstores now, and you can certainly find it on Amazon and pre-order it if they aren't already sending them out.
Let's talk a little bit about the commitment. I was not around at the time of World War II, but from what I've read, the nation really rallied behind this effort in terms of sacrifice. We had rationing of various commodities, sugar and gasoline and rubber and so on, full-fledged commitment. We did not seem to have that in the later wars, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq. Would I be correct in that assessment, sir?
Yes. And I think, you know, you can think back on it a little bit and think about President Roosevelt and the kind of leadership he provided. He, over the course of the war, used 11 fireside chats to explain why we were fighting a global war, why we had to make the sacrifices that we did. And there's one fireside chat in particular I thought that was particularly interesting to take a look at. And that was in February of 1942. Bear in mind that that's like 2 months after Pearl Harbor. And the president, sort of in advance of this broadcast, these were radio broadcasts, he invited everyone in the country to have a map handy. And newspapers were publishing maps of the world, you know, the day beforehand or on the day that the fireside chat occurred. It was February 23rd, 1942. And then the president comes on, I think in the evening, and he spoke candidly and comprehensively about the global situation. I mean, he took the Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, and then he outlined the issues of production and the prodigious effort that would be required to defeat the Axis powers. And he said, never have we had so little time in which to do so much. And this was a broadcast that went on where he sort of walked all of us, who were, you know, alive then. I was a child of maybe 1 year at that point, but for adults, he walked his listeners through the whole world, theater by theater, discussing enemy threats, the logistical issues we faced, the lines of communication, both in the Pacific and the Atlantic and in Europe. And he said, this is a new kind of war. It's different from all the wars we've had in our past, not only in its methods, but also in the kinds of weapons that are being used, and in its geography, which in this case meant it global, and its warfare in terms of every continent, every island, every sea, every airline in the world. These were his words. And then he says, that is why I have asked you to take out and spread before you a map of the whole earth and to follow with me the references which I shall make to the world-enhancing battle lines of this war. And then in another sort of 4,000 words, he walks everybody through all of this.
Wow.
That was a masterful performance by a president. And it showed up in his public polling numbers. They validated his skills in terms of communicating convincingly to the American people. And the polling data ratings throughout the war, and they oscillated between 70 and 80% ranges between 1941 to 1943, and dropped down around 70% for the rest of the war. Winston Churchill's polling numbers were comparable. These guys were leaders who made convincing cases to their countrymen.
We need to take a break. We have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with the John D. Caldwell here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll pick up our conversation with him in just a couple of moments. Be right back.
Butler Ambulance Service not only serves the largest portion of Butler County for 911 ambulance response, but they also offer CPR and first aid training classes and are a leader in wheelchair van assistance too. Butler Assist Coach, a division of Butler Ambulance, provides county residents with medical and non-medical wheelchair van transportation for general doctor visits, shopping, or even transportation to an event. To learn more, visit butlerambulance.com or to schedule a transport, call 724-283-4385. Butler Ambulance Service. Care you can count on.
The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot has delicious, all-natural, free-roaming turkeys and chickens to make your Thanksgiving meal special this year. Their birds are handled with extreme care and are preservative and additive-free. Buy your turkey frozen today or get it fresh right before the big holiday meal. For the tastiest turkeys and chickens in Western PA, call the Jones Turkey Farm, 724-352-2450, or visit jonesturkeyfarm.com. The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot, quite simply the best.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey, and on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, we're talking with John D. Caldwell, defense expert and military historian. He's written a book called Anatomy of Victory, and it compares four wars, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq, compares them side by side. Do you talk about the generals? We've had quite a few generals down through the years. Of course, probably the most famous would be Eisenhower, who, after serving as Supreme Allied Commander, became President of the United States, for goodness sakes.
Absolutely. And Ike, as everybody knew him then, was probably the only candidate who could succeed in holding the coalition together. He had skills that no one else had. He had never really commanded troops, but that isn't what he was required to do. What he would do was think through a series of strategies and operations that were necessary to win the war in Europe, and then to get other generals and leaders, many of whom were, you know, allies of ours, with, in some cases, very strong personalities, to come together and work as a team. And he was masterful at doing that. He brought it off in a way, I think, a lot of historians seem to be in agreement on this, that there wasn't anyone else who quite had that set of skills that Eisenhower had. Part of it was his personality. He had a great winning smile, but he was also a very smart guy who was capable of making decisions, and then enforcing them.
America's next big war came shortly after World War II. World War II ended in 1945, and in the early 50s, we were involved in Korea. There was at least one general, John Caldwell, who was a hero in World War II and then became involved in Korea. That would have been Douglas MacArthur. It didn't go so well for him there. Did politics have something to do with that, or was it simply his actions as a leader?
Well, I think it had to do with overconfidence on the part of Douglas MacArthur. If you remember, about 90 days after the surprise attack by North Korea into South Korea, we were nearly pushed off the peninsula. And MacArthur executed a brilliant counterstroke by 20 miles southwest of Seoul, and essentially interdicting the North Korean army that was further south. And within a matter of, I'd say, 3 weeks, the force had taken Seoul, recaptured Seoul for the second time, and the North Korean army was in retreat all the way across the peninsula heading north. And then MacArthur wasn't really getting very good political guidance from Washington. I mean, he was an intimidating figure. He had his own political ideas. I mean, it was known by many that he was kind of a Republican and had thought about perhaps running for the presidency someday. And so President Truman was somewhat intimidated by him. The result of all of this was that nobody in Washington or in Japan, where MacArthur had his headquarters, was thinking about how is this war really going to end? And what is it going to take to make it come to a successful conclusion? And no one in the summer of 1950, when the invasion occurred, was really thinking about reunification of Korea. But after MacArthur's brilliant amphibious landing at Incheon, people started thinking that way. Well, maybe you can head north across the 38th parallel, which is the border with the People's Republic of China. But the Chinese were telling a lot of diplomats during this period that if the United States did that, they would intervene. There was a council of war at Wake Island in October of that year. We're now sort of about 4 months into the war. And it's, of course, successful, and everybody thinks it's all over but the mopping up and the troops are going to be home by Christmas. But nobody really asked, President Truman included, what was going to happen. This meeting on Wake Island lasted all of a morning, and really the substantive part of it lasted about 90 minutes, and then everybody flew back to where they had come from. This is in the middle of the Pacific. And so the one opportunity that occurred where political leaders and generals, and I'm talking about MacArthur specifically, could have addressed what's going to be the end game for this, didn't really get into it because MacArthur's confidence was overpowering. And at the end of the campaign, General Ridgway, you know, after MacArthur was relieved of command the following year, wrote a book himself about 20 years after the war. And he wrote this: at the end of the campaign, our battle line would have been stretched 420 miles across North Korea's border with the People's Republic of China. And the major responsibility for holding it would have been ours, for it would have been beyond the capability of the Republic of Korea.
Matthew Ridgway, of course, was another famous general from World War II. He ended up the 82nd Airborne. And
absolutely.
Also a Pittsburgh guy. He was from Fox Chapel. And by the way, our guest, John Caldwell, you're originally from Pittsburgh, aren't you, John?
I am indeed.
Yeah. Well, let us move on, just in the interest of time here, to Vietnam. And this was really the first war of the four that you talk about in your book where there was a noticeable lack of support, at least on the part of some Americans, as that campaign dragged on. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yes. Let me begin with an anecdote. My first real job was in Saigon in 1968. I was part of a study team with the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is the sort of the R&D arm of the Department of Defense. It's now known as DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. And my boss was a Marine Corps colonel. He had gotten a Silver Star in Korea, so he was somebody with a fair amount of combat experience. And we were a small team working on this study. It was a classified study. And about a week after I was in Saigon, I met a young officer who was a Harvard ROTC graduate who had already served two combat tours in Vietnam. And he turned to me at one point, this is like 5 minutes after I meet him, and we're going to lose this war. And I said, Jeffrey, how can you make a statement like that? This is a month into the Tet Offensive. And I thought we were holding, you know, we were doing pretty well. We were holding our own. We had 550,000 men committed to this conflict at that point, 10 divisions. We had aircraft carriers offshore that could provide on-call air support 24/7. We had artillery tubes all over the country that could hit any target. We had 1,700 aircraft of the U.S. Air Force committed to the theater. How could we lose, I said. And he stared straight at me and he said, our enemies have a theory of victory, and we don't. So the enduring question of the Vietnam War is explaining how a revolutionary movement led by communists, highly capable communists, was victorious over a 30-year period between 1945 and 1975, despite the massive efforts of two Western powers. First it was France, and then us, to defeat this movement. And we had troops there for well over a decade, almost the better part of 15 years, actually. And we sacrificed nearly 60,000 people. And we still didn't win, except, you know, the irony is we did not lose a single significant tactical engagement, not one. So what would have been a successful strategic architecture in Vietnam? That's what I ask in this book. And I end up by saying, you know, we had, first of all, to have a clearly stated policy that made a compelling case to the American people, and also the South Vietnamese, for why South Vietnam deserves such a massive American national commitment to nation building and to military operations that resulted in the sacrifice of nearly 60,000 American lives. We needed a political strategy that would undermine the communist revolutionary movement's social and economic policy, something more appealing than what the South Vietnamese were offering people in the countryside. That had to be compelling, and it was in the areas of land reform and taxes and military recruitment and administrative staffing. And we needed a military strategy where our own people and the Vietnamese, you know, could integrate their organizations together and essentially, you know, function together and trust each other. And we got that in some cases, but not, we needed it on a national scale. And we needed operations that balanced conventional and counterinsurgency operations, because as events finally showed, the Army of Vietnam had to be capable of both. And we never quite succeeded. That's the sad part of this.
Our time is very short here, but one other war is discussed in John Caldwell's book, Anatomy of Victory, and that's in Iraq. And it would seem to me, to summarize that, Mr. Caldwell, that you know, American support was strong at the beginning, but waned very rapidly as that war dragged on, and you term it a failure, right?
Yes. I mean, the American people get very impatient if we don't succeed. But don't forget, you know, World War II took 4 years. But now with Iraq, I mean, that's a conflict that's actually been going on for a quarter century now. Think about it. I actually call it not the Iraq War, but the Iraqi Wars, because there are five consecutive wars. Victor Davis Hanson started out by identifying three or four of them, and I added another. And War One was the Persian Gulf War. That started in 1990-91 and was over with relatively quickly. That was the one where Saddam invaded Kuwait, and President George H.W. Bush said, our goal is to liberate Kuwait. And we did that. And then everybody came home. But we didn't really think through. President Bush didn't. And neither did General Schwarzkopf, who was the victorious general. We didn't really think through what needed to happen after we defeated the Iraqi army. And so what resulted was a 13-year air war where we were policing some no-fly zones in both northern and southern Iraq, partly to enforce a whole series of UN resolutions throughout this period. And there were a lot more, you know, there was a lot more combat operations than is generally realized during that period. I mean, we flew over 400,000 sorties against various positions and targets during that 13-year period. Then President George W. Bush, the president's son, in 2003 decides to invade Iraq a second time. That's War III, based on what everyone in the intelligence community thought at the time was possession of weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons. That turned out, of course, not to be the case. And again, the conflict was over relatively quickly. When our forces attacked, they were in Baghdad essentially within a month, having advanced, you know, faster than any army in history. And yet we didn't have a plan for figuring out what the end game was after that. And so what did we get after that? We got years of an ugly, violent insurgency that nobody had a plan for dealing with.
Well, it's an interesting comparison of four wars in John D. Caldwell's book, Anatomy of Victory, Why the United States Won in World War II, fought to a stalemate in Korea, lost in Vietnam, and failed in Iraq. Back with more of It's Your Turn here on WISR after this. Coming up, we're going to, we thank our colleague of ours here at the Butler Radio Network, my good friend Bob Kopp, who talked earlier today with David Phelps, formerly of the Gaither Family Band, an outstanding musician, who's going to be coming to Butler for a concert next week, Friday, November 9th, at Community Alliance Church out on the Mercer Road, Friday of next week at 7 p.m. So we thought we'd take a couple of minutes. It's a short interview, but we wanted to share it with you. Bob talking with David Phelps a little bit earlier today.
Well, listeners, if you've ever heard the Gaither Family Band, you very likely have heard the next gentleman we're going to visit with here today, and he is going to give you an opportunity to see him in person at the Community Alliance Church, Friday night, November 9th. That's David Phelps, who joins us here today. David, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, great to talk with you as well. Of course, a long-time American Christian music vocalist and musician. David, let's kind of go through your career a little bit and find out a little bit about you and how you even got involved in music. Did you come from a musical family, per se?
I did. My family used to sing together a lot, and my older sister used to sing with me, and then my other sister plays trumpet professionally up in the Chicago area, and so we are a very musical family. It was something that would just kind of in the genes, I guess.
And by the sound of your voice, sounds like you come from down south, I guess, what, Texas area?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Texas, and now we live in Tennessee, where we raise our family.
How did you ever become involved in the Gaither Band?
Well, I had moved to Tennessee, and I'd always dreamed about working with Bill and Gloria because they're just amazing. And I was actually working on my first record at the time. And in the middle of that, one of the guys came in and said, hey, the vocal band's looking for a new member. So I kind of jumped at the chance and went and auditioned for them. And it just all worked out from there.
Oh, that's awesome. And you were there for quite a few years and have been in and out. But most recently now here within the last, what, year or so, you've decided to pursue the full solo angle.
Yeah, I was with them for a lot of years and also doing solo stuff at the same time. And a year and a half, 2 years ago, something like that, I left the group and have been traveling solo full-time now.
And obviously you'll be here in Butler to perform. Tell the Butler listeners what they'll get an opportunity to hear when you come in.
Well, it's a family program, and it'll be me and my band, and we have a great family-oriented kind of night. It's up-tempo stuff, and ballads that people know, and then some original things as well. So we always have a real good time.
Now, when you're traveling with your particular band, is it some gentlemen that you've known for quite some time? Tell us a little bit about your band.
Yeah, my band, we've been together, most of them about 10, 15 years, something like that. So it is a tight group. And my family travels with me some, too. My sister, as it plays trumpet, she travels with us in the band. And then my two daughters right now are traveling with us as well. And it's a pretty tight-knit group. And also we have, you know, my drum player and guitar and bass and all that kind of stuff. They are just absolutely amazing, and always a privilege to get to sing in front of them.
Pretty cool to have your daughters travel with you and perform. They do some performing as well. It's like the Phelps family band, I guess, huh?
Yeah, you know, I've recorded a few duets with them, with each one of them, and so those have really been crowd favorites. So it's fun to be able to program those and do them on the road like this.
You have some material out right now. I even saw, taking a look at some items, that you even have a Christmas CD.
Yeah, just released our Christmas, a new Christmas project called It Must Be Christmas. It's out in Cracker Barrel and available on our website and stuff. So we actually will be doing a few selections from that ahead of our 20th annual Christmas tour. So.
Fantastic. Where can people find more material on David Phelps? You have a website that people can take a look at as they get ready for the show?
Yeah, they can go to davidphelps.com or all the social media outlets as well. We're on all of those.
Okay, and I know we can get tickets at davidphelps.com or at the Community Alliance Church. Again, the performance gets underway at 7 o'clock Friday, November 9th, and it ought to be a great evening as a Journey of Faith tour comes to Butler, the fall concert series featuring David Phelps. And how long of a show can people expect, David?
Oh, it's usually around a couple hours, something like that.
Okay. Sounds like a great evening of music and a remarkable voice. You've been hearing the commercials leading up to the event, and I'm sure a lot of people are excited to have you in town. David, we appreciate the opportunity to visit with you and wish you the best of luck as you progress here through the fall and certainly ahead to 2019.
Well, thank you, Bob. Thank you for having me with you, and I look forward to being there in Butler.
And we thank our colleague, Bob Kopp. I was busy doing some other stuff this morning, and he was able to chat briefly there with David Phelps so that we could share that interview with you here on the It's Your Turn program. Again, David Phelps, formerly with the Gaither Band, and going to be appearing at Community Alliance Church Friday of next week. It's a week from tomorrow, November 9th, in concert at 7 o'clock. We're still not done. As they say on the midnight infomercials, there's more. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about making soup. Well, that sounds pretty good as we head into the chilly weather season, doesn't it? Yeah. Even today, it's not all that chilly, but it's depressing and dark, and bowl of soup sounds pretty good. We'll be talking with Rachel Beller about that. She's a registered dietitian and soup maker. So that's coming up in a moment. I do want to give you a program note. If any of you out there are map people, and I am a map person, I love to look at maps. I can spend many, many minutes wasting time looking at maps. I've done it. We're going to be talking with a couple of representatives from the National Geographic book company about a book on maps, and I just got my review copy of it, and actually it just came in yesterday, and it is a huge big coffee table book, and there are all kind of different maps in here, some types of maps that I never even heard of before, mapping the moon. We'll talk about it tomorrow with the two guests who'll be with us, Betsy Mason and Greg Miller. So we look forward to that conversation on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. Okay, I take a break here, and then we're gonna make soup with Rachel Beller. It's coming up here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot has delicious, all-natural, free-roaming turkeys and chickens to make your Thanksgiving meal special this year. Their birds are handled with extreme care and are preservative and additive-free. Buy your turkey frozen today or get it fresh right before the big holiday meal. For the tastiest turkeys and chickens in Western PA, call the Jones Turkey Farm, 724-352-2450, or visit jonesturkeyfarm.com. The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot, quite simply the best.
The 2018 midterm elections are here. Just in time, so is The Context, a free newsletter from PA Post. PA Post is a new statewide nonprofit and nonpartisan news organization reporting on state public policy issues. Every weekday morning, The Context provides insights on the races so you can be well informed before you cast your votes. Start your subscription today at papost.org.
We're going to talk about losing weight, folks, perhaps in a way you've never heard before on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. If you're joining us a little bit late, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Rachel Beller, who joins us by phone. You may have heard of Rachel. She is has been seen a lot on television recently. We're talking to her today about her new book, which is entitled Power Souping. First of all, Rachel Beller, hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi.
Nice to have you with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
I won't keep you in suspense if you're thinking, where do I know her from? Rachel Beller is a registered dietitian and nutritionist with a master's degree in nutritional science. So, number one, she knows what she's talking about here. She has served as a nutrition expert for Glamour magazine. She was the nutritionist for NBC's hit TV series, The Biggest Loser. And she's on a lot on World News Tonight, CNN, Good Morning America, Dr. Oz. That's where you've heard of her before. Tell us in a nutshell, Rachel, what power souping is all about. First of all, what's power souping mean?
It's having a lot of power while you're souping. Souping is the new juicing. But it's better because you don't have to give up any of the nutrients. You get all the nutrients you need for a meal in just one bowl. I mean, it's literally that simple. And it's been out for a short time, power souping, and the success stories are pouring in, and that just is, that's really, really what's motivating me here to get really excited about this. So souping is basically meals that are complete in a bowl, and we have chilled breakfast soups that you can blend up. They're like smoothie bowls with toppings, so you feel like you're having like a cereal with toppings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's delicious and filling, and fast and easy. That's the key. Everyone's busy.
Yeah.
And then we have lunch and dinner meals. Some are chilled, some are warm, but they're all easy. And the secret to success is having meals on hand, so you don't have to worry about keeping up so much. So it's been quite a thrill providing the 3-day detox and a 3-week weight loss plan.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. By the way, there are more than 50 simple and delicious recipes in Rachel's book, Power Souping. Very colorful book, by the way, too. Those look gorgeous. These soups look gorgeous.
Thank you.
But let's talk a little bit about the 3-day detox and then the 3-week weight loss plan, because power souping, it's healthy if you can do it, and you know it becomes your way of life. That's terrific. But you also say that you can. This is a really revolutionary way to lose weight, Rachel.
Yes, we have a 3-day detox, which basically is a push on the swing. It really gets people to. You're souping for 3 days, so all your meals are soups,
mm-hmm.
And it's really to get people to feel the difference of eating whole foods. Foods that will help rid their body of potentially harmful compounds, and it really ups their fiber, but in a way that makes them feel comfortable. And it's vegan, so it's not to turn people into all becoming vegan, but really to increase and appreciate having more produce in their life. So, and it's easy. So we start off with that. People can lose, you know, about 3 pounds in 3 days, which is phenomenal. But then we don't let go of your hand. We transition you to a 3-week transformation weight loss plan. You have to soup once a day, either at lunch or dinner, and it teaches you how to plate meals. So that's the reality where people really succeed, because no one's going to soup for the rest of their life. It's an incredible way to eat, and I've been pretty much souping. Every week I make a batch of soup, and it just provides a no-brainer lunch to keep you on track with your diet. So that method carries on for people for years.
Now, let's make one thing clear, because there may be a few listeners who misunderstood exactly what we were talking about here. When we say power souping, we're talking about soups that you make yourself. Folks, these are not the soups that you buy in a can directly off the supermarket shelf. In fact, you begin your book, Rachel, Power Souping, with what you call, kind of laughed at this, food autopsy. And you take a look at, well, for example, how about the so-called convenient canned soup that you might grab off the supermarket shelf, and you take a look at this, you tear it apart, you look at what's in there. Let's take, to give us one example, condensed chicken noodle soup, very popular. Yeah. There are several companies that make it, and a lot of people eat it, and a lot of people give it to their kids. What's in a typical can of popular condensed chicken noodle soup?
Unfortunately, what you look at in a classic chicken noodle soup is a lot of sodium, and people know that, a lot of salt, but really you want to look at what's missing. You're basically getting noodles, which is a processed carbohydrate equivalent to about two slices of white bread, and that's drowning in salt water, and then you get maybe a couple bites of chicken and the vegetables, the primary component of your meal that helps prevent disease and also give you all the fiber that you need to detox, is missing. You've got a tablespoon of chopped carrots, and that's basically it, and some additives, and just it's just lacking so much. It's a far cry from a meal. So I wanted to open up people's eyes to see, you know, these things are missing. They are convenient, but guess what? The recipes in Power Souping are convenient and easy, and you get so much. You get complete meals.
Let's take a quick break. Fortunately, we have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with our guest, Rachel Beller, author of Power Souping, and we'll pick up our conversation with her here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Do you have a discount card at your favorite food store and get special savings? Compassionate Certification Centers is here to get you a medical marijuana card, because with a medical card, prices are half what you pay elsewhere. Don't get stuck paying double for your medical or recreational marijuana. Recreational states charge double if you're not a medical patient. Be ahead of the game. Visit cccregister.com and in three easy steps, get your card. cccregister.com or call 888-316-9085.
Welcome back. We're talking on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Dave Malarkey is my name. Our guest is Rachel Beller, author of Power Souping. So we make our own soups. What about the ingredients? Are these exotic things that we'll have to travel hundreds of miles to find in some kind of specialty store, or can we pretty easily stock our fridge and pantry with this stuff, Rachel?
Absolutely easy to do. There are so many basics, like Tetra Paks, which are like, you know, the almond milk, nut milk containers of low-sodium broth, and you can also buy Tetra Paks with beans these days, which is very easy. Most warehouse stores, general markets have them, and it's basically vegetables. You can literally do no-brainer souping by sautéing an onion, adding some broth, throwing whatever veggies you have on hand, and then you need to add a protein, so it could be a plant-based like beans and legumes, edamame, organic edamame. You can add wild salmon in there, whatever you want to add, and then you just basically add a fat, and you're done. I mean, it's really just teaching the three-step meal-building principles that you could do for plated meals and for souping meals for optimal weight loss and prevention.
And it's okay to use, some of these can be pretty convenient. What about pre-cut frozen veggies and frozen fruits, okay?
Absolutely okay. What people don't realize is many of the frozen fruits and vegetables have more nutrients than some of the produce sitting, fresh produce, because they're picked at their peak and then frozen immediately. So they're the nutrients get locked in. So people assume that the frozen fruits and vegetables lack nutrients, but quite on the contrary, and it's a very inexpensive way to get good produce, even organic produce. So the freezer could be your best friend when it comes to that.
You also, you call high-quality oil your go-to. And you have a section in here where you talk about different kinds of oil and what's best and what's not so good.
Yes. I like to keep on hand olive oil, extra virgin olive oil for high heat, cold-pressed olive oil for cold foods, walnut oil, which is high in omega-3s, very good for breast health as well, avocado oil, which is the new olive oil, it's popping up everywhere, even at warehouse stores. Which is excellent. And those are some basic oils to keep on hand. You don't need too many.
What do you use when you need to sweeten something, or dare you?
Dare I? I sometimes use a date, for example. I like to add one date into a smoothie bowl in the morning. So that's the best way to go, or a little bit of raw honey or pure maple. But again, these are just a touch.
Uh-huh.
A touch, a little bit goes a long way, and it's all about training your palate. I mean, all these foods are clean, but they're really, you're adjusting your palate. So if you have an artificial sweetener, for example, that intense sweetness, you're going to crave sugar on and on and on because you're training your palate to want more intense sweetness. So this really teaches you how to appreciate food for what it is, and it's super economical.
I've never liked any of the artificial sweeteners. In fact, I think they taste horrible.
It does. I'd rather have a little bit of a real thing.
Me too. What about, I know you've got a section on snacks in here because everybody wants snacks, but you've got a page of two pages of extremely colorful, several pages of extremely colorful, wholesome, and simple snacks.
Yes. We do pay attention to calories even from whole foods. Especially at snack time. It's so easy to overdo it. So we have a spread, actually it's not even soups, nuts and fruits in different portions, and you could just mix and match as you wish, and it just makes it easy. It's just a visual infographic to create simple snacks. And then we also have souping snacks, which are also very easy to blend together if you want. And then we have regular snacks. So we really give you a taste of everything.
By the way, soups, you have both cold soups and hot soups, so it's not just one or the other.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There's, we're in springtime, actually, and summer, and there are a lot of chilled soups and warm soups. So there's really something for every single season, so people can start the plan no matter what season it is and begin to really forever change the way they think about what they put in their body. That is the key mission behind this book.
Folks, all you got to do is look at the pictures on the cover of this book. you don't even have to open it to realize how appetizing and appealing these soups can be. And as Rachel said, there's also a section on plated meals. The title of the book is Power Souping, 3-Day Detox. That's first stage. And then a 3-week weight loss plan. And Rachel says you could maybe drop 3 pounds in a 3-day detox and maybe as much as 15 pounds in a 3-week weight loss plan, which sounds pretty good to just about anybody, I think, Rachel.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's realistic.
Mm-hmm. Listen, thanks for talking with us. I know you have a very busy day. Rachel Beller, registered dietitian nutritionist with a master's degree in nutritional science, author of Power Souping, visiting with us today. Thanks, Rachel. Nice to meet you.
Thanks. Nice meeting you, too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 03. The pick 3 is 962. The pick 4, 4120. The pick 5, 87723. The wild ball for each of those is 5. The treasure hunt, 1, 2, 4, 8, and 11. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
The Pens will wrap up their home-and-home set with the New York Islanders on Thursday night in Brooklyn when the two teams meet for the second time in 48 hours. Get set for all the action with Penguins Live pregame hitting the air at 6:30 p.m. And after that, we go to the booth at Barclays Center where Josh Getzoff and Phil Bork have the call of the Pens in the Isles starting at 7 o'clock on the Penguins Radio Network.
Pittsburgh Penguins Hockey brought to you in part by Cash Dollar & Associates, Thrower Concrete, Monday Shoes, Camisa's Auto Body, Butler Agway, and Schneider's 1 Hour Heating and Air Conditioning.
It's up-to-the-minute local, national, and world news from WISR Butler, Pennsylvania, and the CBS Radio News Network.
This is your station for the Pittsburgh Steelers, WISR Butler.